That's right, we're back. Welcome to Pipe and Slip Mats, Volume 4, the podcast with one foot in the rave with me, Scott.
Me, James.
And me, Tunde.
Let's drop a tune.
I know I always say I bloody love that record, like every single week, but I bloody love that record.
It's so good.
But I would have said that's SL2. That's where I don't know anything.
There is an element of that, and I'm sure Tunde will talk us through it in a sec, but for me, it was just, you know how I love Sasha, I might mention that before. That was absolute integral part of his sort of 89, 90s set.
A few people have sampled that stab. I think everyone knows it's a landlord
Tunde,
stab.
What's a stab?
Dank. So it's like a really short sort of, it could be a piano stab, it could be a brass stab. It's pretty self-explanatory. It's like punk.
A stab.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we should probably tell people what the tune actually is so they can go out and find it for themselves. It's Landlord and
I don't know, it's a Landlord track. I think it is called, is it Blowout or something like that?
What we do, what people often forget, is the prep. To prep the show, to spend their time. And what I find people love most about this show is the research.
Yeah,
that's right. Meticulous, I think, is the word that springs to mind,
isn't
it?
It's just weeks, isn't it?
It's just pure rigour.
It's why there's such a long delay between each episode.
Well, because we're spending so long deep in the song.
I know it sounds like three clueless guys, you don't know what the tune is. Sorry, Tunde, what's the track?
I like it.
Okay, yeah, still doesn't know.
I like it by Landlord.
Yes,
and it's and the riff that I'm thinking of is
so SL2 used the stab
for DJs Take Control.
Yes.
Was it?
Yeah. We've got to play people a bit of that. Can we play people a bit of that?
Yeah, let's play DJs Take Control.
And then obviously Cal Cox used it for
I Want You.
Was it I Want You or was it Let the Bass Kick?
Oh, it might be Let the Bass Kick. We'll come back to you on that.
All the same.
Oh, yeah. And we've used it back in the day as well.
Have you? Actually,
yeah, we did a track for Metalhead. Can I say that?
I think you can say
will I be sued for sampling?
Don't.
So people might notice that the frequency of this show has actually improved ever so slightly.
Has it?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, if you remember the first one, there was a 7-year gap between the first and second.
Yeah.
So we've improved upon that. But we're actually recording this just pre-Christmas. But let's talk about New Year, because everybody goes out in New Year. It's the one proper big night of the year. Personally, one of my most memorable ones was actually Ministry of Sound at the Dome. It was when I was working at Ministry, and I remember on New Year's Eve, I was stood behind Paul Oakenfold, your mate, my mate, as you recall from the last show, while he dropped the 12 o'clock tune.
Yeah, all I remember is you talking about Paul Oakenfold eating sushi.
Yeah. He talked a lot about sushi. But, it was a real moment, actually. There was maybe 10,000 people
what
in the Millennium Dome.
What did he play?
It was something Goa Trance. I knew
crack?
You were going to ask me that. Yeah, I'm not a Goa Trance fan, so
no,
yes.
We established that
I did enjoy it, but, 9,999 people did enjoy it.
Did they? Are we talking, is this the Millennium? Is this the year 2000?
Yeah, exactly.
In
that.
The Dome?
In the Dome.
Oakenfold dropping some Goa Trance.
Yeah, and me going nuts behind him.
Should probably stick for the sushi. No, I don't mean that. But New Year's for me is always like a huge anticlimax. I remember going to World Dance quite regularly in New Year's Eves, and you would always be waiting for that track. I remember being in Ali Pally World Dance, and they played Born Slippy, which was particularly... It was all right. Mm. It was like expected.
I'm not a fan, I'll be honest with you.
Do you know what?
No,
I'm not.
No, don't
I'm
like
pleased
you
said that.
Don't like it at all. I don't get it. Most of Underworld, bar maybe Rez and Cowgirl, I'm not a big fan
of
Underworld.
Sorry, Underworld, if you're listening.
I think the flip side of that was good.
Which one?
Of Born Slippy.
Was it?
What was it? I can't remember.
It was more like a breakbeat.
Okay.
It should stick.
Yeah,
to
I mean, basically, when what's his name, Carl Hyde didn't sing. That's when they worked for me.
Did you ever interview them?
I've interviewed Darren Emerson, who's a lovely bloke. But
caveat.
There's no caveat. He's a genuinely lovely bloke and a great DJ. But yeah, the band left me cold.
Born Slippy, well, it was a soundtrack to a film, which made it so. But it was so ubiquitous, you heard it everywhere. So even though that bit, that soaring, quite weird sounding vocal bit was good, everything else was just a bit pounding. It's a bit audio bullies. Not that I've got anything wrong about the audio bullies, but it was a bit pounding, incessant. There's nothing else going on.
Awful is what I think.
That was my New Year's. Really fun.
Tendo, you must have a New Year's.
You must have played New Year's.
Yeah, you must have DJed New Year's.
Actually, there's two. One of them when I was a kid, it used to be a box carrier for older DJs. And there used to be this guy called Paul Walker, who was like sort of my idol.
Manchester DJ.
Yeah. I can remember he was doing Angel in Burnley, somewhere else, and somewhere else New Year's Eve. So we had three clubs New Year's Eve, and it's got to be probably one of the best New Year's Eves ever. I was
really?
About 17 or 18.
I want to know about Angel in Burnley.
Oh, it was amazing.
Go on.
River and Quest were playing, I think. So,
really?
Yeah. So do you know Mark Hadfield?
No.
I
know the name.
Yeah. So you know, you've probably seen about his car. He's still producing now.
Rhythm Quest I had on cassette single, Closer to All Your Dreams, and it had like a cyborg robot on the front, and it felt like a ZX Spectrum computer game.
They were like the pin-up boys
it
of Manchester
wicked.
At the time. And so they were on, and then I think the next club we went to, Entrance were on.
Oh, Set You Free.
Yeah, Set You Free.
Bloody love.
Right, and then there was like, we went to...
not so keen, Scott.
Not massively keen.
As a 17-year-old kid going to three clubs on New Year's Eve, it was great.
Winner.
And then DJing. We've got some good...
Have you had to DJ a lot of New Year's Eve over the years?
Oh, yeah, but I don't know. I used to... a lot of the gigs were in London, so and Darren lives... He's from London, I'm from Manchester.
Yeah.
So he used to get like a phone call from me, sort of like the day before.
Calling in sick.
Oh, mate, yeah.
Heavy one.
Oh,
Christmas has hit me hard.
I don't make it. But,
what would be your New Year's Eve track?
Well, luckily we had a song. We had quite a big drum and bass song called Midnight.
Did you?
Yeah, so that became the song.
Your New Year's Eve anthem, yeah. Nice.
That's reminding me of Westbam Alarm Clock, which we must have played.
No, I don't think we have.
What?
No, honestly.
We must have played.
No, but we totally should.
Well, let's bloody play it. But before we do, Westbam Alarm Clock, I don't know why it does, but you just said midnight. It's a clock. There must be a clock theme that we can do on a future show. But Westbam Alarm Clock, Scott introduced me to many years ago when we used to do a lot of parties in my then flat in Crouch End, which were terrific fun. One particular night Westbam Alarm Clock reminds me of is when we let off a confetti cannon into a pretty small room, ultimately, which I probably cleared that confetti out for at least 5 years afterwards. And you've never found more confetti in unsuspecting places for years afterwards. But West Ham Alarm Clock is a brilliant, brooding, and it's built around the sound of an alarm clock. You wouldn't believe it's good.
Maybe we should play it.
Let's play it.
To say which bit of that tune they liked the most, I think it was the bit when the alarm clocks just all started ringing for like 30
seconds.
It's like
the opening scene in Back to the Future. Cindy, you look deeply unimpressed. This is not as good as I remember.
Yeah. I mean,
it's 91. It's of the era. I think we're all right. I think we're safe.
Do you know what? Can I just put another tune on from that same era?
Yeah. I like this. Is this what we do now?
Do we just play music?
Because I'm really into it.
I'm going to play D Living Y from 1990.
I don't remember.
Just to show the difference.
Okay, lovely.
Life is all about sex and money.
Because we actually asked for some feedback on the last show. We actually got some feedback on the last show. There are a few comments. Shout-outs to Charlie C, to Tom Coxhead. Some of the genuine feedback was, like it, lads, you obviously have a laugh doing it. I think that's a compliment. another piece of feedback was, maybe you want to play some more music. Well, guess what? We just played about 12 tracks in the opening bit. Which I think is beneficial for the listener.
It's a bit like being back at either of our houses when we just keep changing the music every 30 seconds. Going, no, I've just thought of a better one.
It's
pretty similar to that, except normally we do this at about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, it's one-upmanship in pure and simple. Let's get back to the script, the well-honed script, the well-researched script, Scott. Where are we at?
Where are we at? Well, we were going to talk a little bit about DJs and their pseudonyms. And in a little while we can play a bit of Todd Terry. Now, Todd Terry, two things. Famously only plays his own records when he DJs, but also goes under lots of different names. So he was Black Riot, he was Royal House, he was Dreams of Santa Anna. I just think it's interesting that dance music is more faceless than a lot of other music. So faceless, in fact, that I wanted to share a little story about how I pretended to be a famous DJ.
What, you?
Yeah.
Go on.
It was Newcastle, 1990. I moved there from Birmingham, and I assumed, stupidly, that Newcastle people were sort of, didn't know much about dance
Why
music.
Why would you assume that?
I don't know, because I'd lived in Birmingham, and I just thought, they don't know much up there.
Well, did you go further north?
So I was working, I had this job, and I, for some mad reason, told somebody that worked there that I was quite a famous DJ from the Midlands, and I'd just moved up to Newcastle to sort of, you know, try my luck up there.
I like the way Scott says, for some reason I said that. Yeah. Oh, I wonder
I was trying to impress a girl.
Were you
chirps? Yeah, I was. You're absolutely right. I was literally trying to impress a girl.
For some unknown reason, I said I was an incredible DJ.
And they said, what was your DJ name? And I thought, well, my name's Scott. So it literally said Doc Scott. Now, anybody that knows dance music will know Doc Scott is a very, very famous drum and bass DJ. At the time, he wasn't as famous as he is now. So I thought I can get away with it. I thought that was the end of it. And then about a week later, this girl that I'd been boasting to brought in this sort of long-haired chap, raver-looking guy into the place I was working and said, oh, he wants to talk to you because he's putting on a rave and he wants to know if he can book you.
Oh, no.
And that was it. I was stuck.
Oh,
I couldn't say, no, I'm not that guy. So I just said, yeah, well, you know, send me your detail. When is it? Yeah, I think I'm free.
How much did you charge?
And I'm thinking, and it was a couple of £100, and I'm thinking, what do I do? And
take
I just,
the money.
Classic, I just thought, I'll just sort of, you know, stick my head in the sand and maybe it'll somehow go away. But the next thing I hear, about 2 weeks later, is on the local pirate radio station, they're doing an announcement for this rave with me headlining.
No.
They're announcing my name.
Oh my
God. And then flyers go up around Newcastle with Doc Scott headlining.
Oh no.
And by this time, obviously, I was really, really worried.
What must the real Doc Scott have thought of this? Because he must have thought, I'm not fucking headlining the
Newcastle. I'd like to apologise to him now. It was a very, very, very long time ago.
What is this, 30 years ago?
About 20 years ago.
20 years ago, Doc Scott. Here is the moment that Scott has been building to for the last two decades.
And so, as it transpired, I actually ended up, for some mad reason, going to the club. It was the Blue Monkey Club in Sunderland. I went to James just spat his beer.
Love that club.
I went to the Blue Monkey Club on that night for some.
Sounds like a zoo.
I don't know why. And I brought the record box with me. I went into the club, and then I suddenly had this blinding moment of clarity. I thought, what the hell are you doing? You're not Doc Scott. There's 1,000 people here to see him. They're instantly going to know you're not him.
Oh, this is terrible.
So I had to go out of fire escape and literally flag down a cab and leave.
Oh, mate.
And why
did you get to that point?
I honestly don't know. It was one of the worst moments of my life.
then you just jumped in a cab.
I did a runner, yeah. And
what happened to all the people waiting to see Doc Scott?
I have no idea. And
so you've actually got a lot of apologies.
And then I left my job. I couldn't get back to the job because this guy was actually a fairly unsavoury character, and I knew he was going to come in there with his mates. And for the next sort of year that I lived in Newcastle before I went to uni, I was absolutely so worried that at some point I was going to bump into him and his boys in the city centre.
All of that because you tried to chirps a girl.
Isn't that there's a lesson isn't there?
I tell you what the lesson. I don't know, mate, but that's maybe the best story you've told.
boasting to women about something you're not.
That is absolutely
so beautiful. Doc Scott, once again, I couldn't apologise more, and
please, someone
love
out
your music.
There, we don't have many listeners, but one of you will know Doc Scott. I'm desperate for
I've
you to share this
Doc Scott question. I should put it to Tunde because he's a drum and bass expert.
Is he a real doctor?
Is Doc Scott a real doctor?
I'm going to go no.
Well, you know.
Oh, I suppose it depends how you define being a doctor.
Totally. Well, I normally define it by
someone who's got a medical
being a doctor
degree.
Of medicine.
If you think mixing impeccably well
is
medicine for the ears,
well, there you go.
He's a doctor.
There you go. I mean, he did put out his big track, actually, was the NHS EP. So, you know, he's sort of throwing it in our face there, going, oh, am I or am
is
I not? Really? Yeah, it's called the NHS EP. Yeah.
I mean, I would say shadow boxing was probably...
Shadow boxing. He had another one for surgery as well, I think. So, you know...
Get the doctor loose. illusion.
Kept that running. Yeah. So we're not all, some of us are also pretending to be something we're not. Please don't sue me.
But I'm desperate for Dr. Scott to hear this story. I just want the comment.
I think I've got his number somewhere.
Please, God, send him this segment.
Yeah.
After a certain amount of time.
Is it fraud?
You can't be arrested for a crime.
Did you take the money? Did you take your first half?
No, I didn't take any money. No.
Is all your money gained from that night?
Because there could be, what do you call it? What's the thing
fraudulent?
Now? No, what, when you go after, is it punitive damages?
Yeah.
So all the money there's probably interest as well.
Yeah.
Actually, let's not put any ideas into his head.
Because Scott is a smart fella.
Your career over the past 30 years has all been based on a lie.
Doc Scott should take a cut of every earning you've made for the last 30 years, actually.
Yeah, all the money you heard from...
When you were editor of Loaded and Ministry, mate, all that money. That's a great story.
So,
I've got one similar.
Go on.
But in fact, it's not similar. It's really rubbish compared to that. But there used to be a club, in Warrington called Mr. Smith's.
Nice.
And
it was
a real sort of, it was like Hitman and Her club, do you know what I mean? Like proper
bit of me there.
Sharon and Tracy. But on a Monday used to put a rave on.
I would have loved it.
And Carl Cox was there. And Carl Cox has got a gap in his teeth. And when I was 16 and 17, I looked pretty much like I do now.
See where this is going.
Yeah. But I had a bald head.
Okay.
So I was 17 but I looked about 28.
So you thought I'm him?
No. I was in Manchester. And someone was like, I was at a record shop and he needed a record box. Someone was like, you're going up, can you bring this record box up for Carl Cox? So I was like, okay.
I like that.
So get up there quite early because my friend's a DJ.
Yeah.
Turn up, there's a massive queue for about 1,000 people. I turn up with a gap in my teeth, bald head, with a big record box.
Here we go.
So everyone's like, oh my God, Carl Cox is here.
Brilliant. So they've made that assumption. You've
I've not said anything. And because all the bouncers opened the door for me because I'm working.
Yeah, of course.
So everyone's like, and I go to the toilet and some kid comes up and asks for my autograph.
Oh, that's sweet. What did you sign it?
Did you sign it
Tunde or Carl?
Well, I made it illegible so he couldn't tell whether it's Tunde or Carl.
Or was it like Carl Tunde?
Yeah, Tunde Cox.
This is sweet. This is cute. This is misleading. It's not like Scott, for example, who really went out of his way
to
deceive.
Pure identity fraud.
Yeah. He wasn't criminal. Yeah.
You've made it, you know, they're making their mistakes.
Making
it's not your fault.
It's not my fault.
You're simply making
it. I've just signed an autograph.
Yeah.
Illegible.
Yeah, we've all signed autographs.
Yeah.
They're my favourite stories for a long time. Doc Scott. The doctor, what's next?
Well, I thought we might talk a little bit about... We talk a lot about how much we love raves and all the great things about them. I thought we might talk a little bit about the things that we definitely don't miss about them. And for me, it's interesting, you talked about the guy trying to get your autograph when you're having a piss. You know, generally blokes bothering you, usually sweaty blokes with tops off, hugging you. I think there was a brief moment of a month or two when that seemed acceptable, and then it suddenly became massively unacceptable.
When was it acceptable to have a...
I think at the birth of your rave honeymoon.
You got sweat all over you and the guy
right
is like
at the beginning.
Into your own
face. And he's got a dummy in his face.
When's that acceptable? When is that possibly a good thing? Because I don't need that in my life.
Well, no, I quickly learned that I didn't need it in my life either.
It wouldn't take much learning. A muscle-bound guy with sweat all over you and his dummy.
Well, sometimes they might be offering you poppers, in which case, you'd be like...
I take it back.
What a great guy.
Yeah.
The poppers, what a horrible drug.
Oh,
I mean,
God.
You know...
Is it a drug?
Well, I don't know what it is. It's a room deodorizer if you actually read
the packaging. Officially, that's what a popper is.
Yeah, that's the official...
We definitely talked about this on the first ever show 7 years ago, and our great friend...
We did talk a bit about
our great friend. We can call him out now. He won't mind.
Yeah.
Hazy,
yeah.
He loved poppers.
He did. But they're horrible. They just make your head explode.
Yeah.
Turn your cheeks red, and then after 20 seconds, you're like, why did I
Where's
do that?
Where's the fun?
Where's that sweaty guy? Come back.
Yeah, I want more. But no, a guy grappling with you as you're trying to dance to Doc Scott on the deck.
Not my scene. The other thing I remember a lot about is tinnitus, you know, getting the ringing in the ears after a big rave. And I want to know, when you're DJing in an incredibly loud club, do you wear ear protectors under your headphones or anything like that?
Yeah, I used to. You used to get moulds.
So right.
You get them.
Custom moulds.
Yeah, get custom moulds. And then you can decide whether it's going to be... You can knock in... You put these filters in. So that would be 10 dB quieter or 15 or 30.
dB?
Yeah.
What is dB?
Decibel.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
So it's what they measure...
But would you work that out in the club? Would you go, the tens aren't big enough tonight, I need a 25 dB?
No, you just, it'd be having a conversation. You put your earplugs in and you, if you were speaking, then I could hear you a little bit quieter.
How would that affect you mixing and DJing?
Well, for me, I used to take them out when I was DJing.
Gotcha.
And then put them back in. So we go back to back.
Were they an essential part of the kit?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, because then you wouldn't get ringing.
I like that. I never knew that.
Yeah, there's a lot of old DJs who are partially deaf.
That still wears them now. That wears them in the studio.
Really?
Mm.
Darren wears...
Well, I'm not surprised, given how loud you were playing.
To be honest, I walked in earlier, mate, and I could barely breathe.
See, I lost him because the best thing about it was when I first had my first child, and obviously the crying and that, I used to wear them.
Yeah, so.
I bet your other half loved that.
I think that's probably why she's not moving around anymore.
Got the 10 dBs in.
Yeah, I was like, do you know, I didn't cry now? I was like,
no, I didn't hear a thing. Felt like you slept through.
Just a little bit, not enough to make me stir.
I don't like having my hearing impaired like that. It freaks me out. It even freaks me out on the tube or the train when I got my headphones in. I can't deal with the fact that I don't know everything going on.
No, you can. That's the thing, because it just turns it down.
Right. So it's just a dull effect rather than a shutout.
No, it's not a shutout. Like it's like literally...
fat pair of beats.
It's like listening from music really loud to semi-loud or from...
Nice.
Semi-loud to quiet.
Nice. And did you suffer... you must have done it. I remember you told a story once about basically... Or was it a guy that you met used to stand in the speakers? Anyway.
I think I might have slept in them or something, yeah.
Yeah, you slept in some speakers, right?
Bin, yeah.
But the point is, you must have had many an occasion you come out of a rave and you couldn't hear a thing.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Has it worried you? You've completely gone...
Recently, like if I've DJ, was it Fire and Vauxhall last year? And that was loud.
Shout out Johnny.
Oh, yeah, our mate Johnny loves that place. Yeah.
Sorry, Karen.
He's a member, isn't
he? Yeah. VIP.
And Mia's ringing for 2 days, and I was worrying then. I was thinking, is this ever going to...
Well, yeah, because you think, are we done here?
Yeah.
Is this it?
Yeah, at my age now.
Yeah, what are you, 60?
27.
Yeah. 27.
Late, extreme.
Late 27.
Extreme 20s.
Sorry, Scott, we've gone off on one.
No,
on
it's fine. I'm thinking, so
EMFs.
Yeah, no, I think we've talked a lot about things that are great about raves, but maybe it's time to play a big rave anthem.
Oh, go on.
What
have we got lined up?
Well, I was thinking either...
Sesame Street.
No, not Sesame Street.
Oh, Urban Hype.
Not that either.
That's a jam, though.
It's a jam. Bloody terrible. I thought I knew you guys. I really did.
Magic
Mountain.
I was thinking
the New Atlantic, I Know.
Okay.
Oh, my, really? Why don't you play Oceanic?
To be fair, I love Oceanic.
So that was brilliant. That's New Atlantic, I know. Massive northern tune. Tunde, you must have heard this.
Yes, I have.
But I understand you're going to try and play Bizarre Inc. Or Playing With Knives, which for me has just been so played out and I'm so bored of it. Are we seriously going to play it?
But there's a different mix. There was two vinyls that came out, I think roughly at the same time. One was the red one. Was it red? Yeah, with which everyone knows. And there's the Climax mix, which was a yellow vinyl.
Yellow sleeve, should I say.
So okay. I'll play this one.
Okay, cool. Let's have it. Take it back. That Bizarre track is pretty good, actually. I like that a lot.
It's fantastic.
But I mean, one of the things that I also used to love about Raves was the fact that you would still hear a mix of music before it sort of splintered into happy hardcore and went into sort of dark jungle. So you could still hear different types of music at Raves, and that's what I used to love about it. And you would hear a bit of hip hop or more hip house, actually. Hip house you don't hear enough hip house.
Describe hip house.
Doug Lazy, Let It Roll, Tony really? Scott, That's How I'm Living.
Jungle Brothers,
I'll house you. So it is essentially people rapping over a house beat, and I don't know why. Maybe it sounds too
would
cheesy
people be
these
up
days.
For it? In the raves, then, would people be up for it? Would they embrace the difference? Would they embrace the diversity? The different.
Well,
there was a much more
diverse crowd, I would argue.
Well,
in raves.
I definitely think the people who were making the tunes, especially people from the UK, were sampling records, their record collection.
Right.
And most of the record collections were probably early hip hop.
Yeah.
So all the things like Let the Bass Kick In.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I'll House You. All this was just samples of people of their record collection and they put it into dance.
Do you reckon
music.
Dance music is a worse place for the fact that that's less done now?
No, I think it's still done. I just think it's probably done in different forms of dance music.
Right.
Also, it's probably a lot more expensive to clear a sample now.
Yeah.
Well, in those days, they probably didn't even try and clear it very often, did they?
As per Tunde.
Yeah.
Sorry, going back to Tunde's £48 owing to whoever it was.
Metalheads are just collecting their cash.
If you take probably what the kids are doing now, loads of them are just sort of remixing old stuff. So they're listening to an old dance song and then thinking I'm going to bring it back up to
but two, and when you were playing, if you were playing out, if you were DJing, all right, maybe a year or two after, but would you find that people were up for? I really love this idea that actually there's a little bit more of a range maybe played, there's a little bit more of a breadth. Would you find that when you DJed, or was it like we're here for this and this only, and anything skewing away from that would be a problem?
I mean, definitely at the start, Sasha and Fabio will be on the same.
Which is incredible to think about that.
When
now.
It first started, where that wouldn't happen.
Sasha
now.
Would hand over to Fabio and Groover, I think.
And would it feel seamless?
Yes,
because the rave started off, you'd have like say from 12 till 4, it'd be more piano, house led, and then as it got later and later, it'd get darker and more harder and
Fabio
hardcore.
Would come on.
And you end up with like the likes of Groove Rider at the end.
6-8.
And then obviously you had kids who were into all that, and then some kids were like, well, actually, I prefer the 12 till 4 stuff, and then kids would be like, between the.
It's
the
almost
four
like
till
the entire
stuff.
Rave actually followed more. You know, like a DJ set and the way it takes you on a journey and all of that lovely, and the story and the narrative of the set and the up and the down, the ebb and the flow. It's almost like the rave that you two are describing then would actually echo and mirror that you had all of those beautiful fluctuations and the different styles and the different tonality. I'm not sure I sense that now in club, and I think you go there for I might be wrong. I think you go there for a certain vibe.
Yeah, of course. Well, I don't know if you remember. I don't know if it was the same down here, but some of the raves I used to go to, everyone would be, it'd be like background music. So everyone would go in first, and then at 12 o'clock, the lights would go off, and the DJ would start with a full club. People wouldn't be walking in.
That's interesting. So you would get the kind of background elevator music.
Yeah,
kind of
everyone would get,
really, when you're sucking them in and people are just mingling and stuff.
Yeah.
And then it would go.
Yeah.
Then it would be like 3, 2, 1, bang, press the green button, we're fucking off.
Yeah.
I like that.
I don't remember that. I remember things, having, as James said, an ebb and a flow, but I don't remember sort of silence.
stony silence.
I'm not talking about
prison.
Clubs, I'm talking about like raves, where it'd be a warehouse.
Oh, you need to wait for it all to kick up,
it'd be like literally.
Yeah. No,
everyone would be getting
a lot
there.
Of people milling about.
A lot of people milling
like a garage
about.
Forecourt.
Yeah. No, I do remember that. You're absolutely right. Because there was always that great uncertainty about whether it would happen or not. You might just be milling about in a warehouse and actually either the promoter's taken the money and done a runner or the police have just arrived.
Talk about that, because that is alien for so many people. So the idea that there's, hundreds of you just stood about.
It was part of the fun. I remember walking around the back streets of Birmingham city centre in a sort of broken down warehouse part of the city centre now, which is probably luxury flats, and literally milling about, hundreds of us listening for the beat, knowing this. We'd all paid 20 quid off some scouser and we were wondering
always
around going, it must be around here somewhere, and just thinking, but there was always that uncertainty, goes either we've been totally done or it's been shut down,
so can we just,
or the electrics
I just need
working.
To drill into that a bit more. You're listening like you are cock-headed, ear up in the air, genuinely trying to hear a distant beat.
Yeah, or see a flicker of a strobe
to locate. Like, I can't say
kind of
how
godforsaken, you imagine sort of broken down Detroit, like godforsaken wasteland of crumbling
and
buildings.
And you're trying to, you're like, I just need to try and hear the beat. You're shushing people so you can hear
and
if there's a distant
and
break.
And there'd be the odd person goes, I know where it is, and everyone would run after him and go, oh, he didn't know where
it
was at all.
It's amazing. And you're all running after a skip.
And it was just done on a bigger scale with the Orbital, the M25 raves, whereas you'd be doing the same thing but following people in cars.
Yeah.
It was essentially the same process. Follow somebody who looks like they know what they're doing.
Yeah, there's countless stories, aren't there, of you're following people in cars and they're just simply going home. And there's like 28 people in a convoy going up a dark kind of countryside track and someone's just going back to their lovely home. Get out of the car and they're like, there's no rave.
But then sometimes you'd end up at, I remember ending up at Sunrise once, arriving, we'd taken us ages to find it. We got there about 3 a.m, managed to park in some field and got there, and you could see you could hear the bass thump, you could see the lights of the fairground and stuff they had going on. And just as we arrived in the heart of it, talking of hip house, Doug Lazy came on at 4 a.m. just as we arrived at Sunrise.
Bloody hell.
It must have been 89, something like that.
How good was
that? That was a that,
how
that,
good was
if
that?
If I put it in top 5 clubbing moments,
oh,
that's
really?
Got to be
should
one
play
of
Doug
them.
Lazy?
Yeah, let's play Let It Roll.
Fuck. Can we play as well? Can we play Kid and Play 2 Hype Remix?
Yes.
Have you heard that?
No.
Alright, let me play that.
Play it.
turn like a windmill. I'm on track when I hit this. As a matter of fact, I don't miss this target. I score like a marksman. Break down and I'm sparking like a jumper cable. Cause I'm able to rock this label. And I'm on when the tempo's swifter. Up to fifth gear, I'm the shifter. You can get this like a present. Bass is loud but never unpleasant. So when the music's got your soul, yo, just let it roll, let it roll.
Absolute banger. Love that. Honestly, chaps, I've thoroughly enjoyed tonight. This has been great. Who would have thought 7 years ago when James and I had an idea to sit down and do this, that we'd be where we are now. Tunde's come along, made it 10 times better, fully professional setup, and now we've got a bit of a surprise because we've got our first ever guest, and he's a brilliant guest. I'm so pleased that he could speak to us. His name's Charlie Chester. So those of you who are clubbers of a certain vintage will know him as a godlike figure in clubland. He started Flying Records and Flying the record label. He was instrumental in the film, a short film about Chilling, one of the most famous films ever made about club music. He runs a brilliant luxury events and travel company in Ibiza now, and I believe we've got him on the line right now. Charlie, hello.
Hola, mate. How are you? Okay?
I'm good, mate. Thanks again for doing this.
No problem.
I guess I'll just kick off by first of all saying it's great that we've got one of Clubland's living legends on the phone right now. We are not worthy. Charlie, you've done so much in your time in Clubland, and obviously what you're doing now with the luxury Ibiza business. But where did it really start for you?
Just when it started, 88, 89, there was the crossover between what went on before then. That was always in my book, led by Nicky Holloway. We used to go to his weekenders and his soul and, well, soul things. And then he flipped over at that complete time and started the trip at Astoria. And, you know, Paul Dennis running stuff and doing stuff at Heaven. And that's where the and then there was the all-nighters in Slough out there. So that's where it started for me, just straight in on Pete Tong was doing a story for Nicky Holloway as well. That was my personal experience. And then we decided that we wanted to do a night, and we started doing flying at Queen's on a Tuesday night. I think our first night was some ridiculous end of January on a Tuesday night we did. I mean, why would you do that? It is just ludicrous. But it was such a bubble and a wave at that time. I think we closed the doors within an hour of it opening with 700 people inside.
Do you think it was easier to get a lot of people to a club in those days because there were fewer clubs of that type around?
Yeah, it was, but it was just the start of something that was has proven to be a game changer. You know, 30 years on, my daughter's going to these clubs. It's just, I guess it's like rock and roll, isn't it? It does. just not falling out of fashion and keeps moving, keeps evolving, keeps developing. You know, my daughter's now in the industry as well. She works for Listen Up. Huh. So she's now managed, or, you know, she's in press. She's looking after Steve Lawler, or was. I don't know if she's, you know, she's looking after my mate in press. I mean, how would I have expected that on a Tuesday night in Coldbrook?
And was,
you know what I mean?
Was flying the kind of game changer for you? I mean, obviously you did Queens, but was flying when you actually thought, okay, there's a living to be made in this full time?
Well, flying started on the Tuesday night at Coldbrook, and then we got offered the Soho Theatre Club, but it was no more than just a complete and utter laugh. And we moved it to the Saturday night in London. And I was a little bit nervous about, you know, I wouldn't, you know, I'd always been going to the Wag Club and places like that. I knew London like the back of my hand. But moving your night from, you know, I'm not from Berkshire, but obviously there was a lot going on in Berkshire, but we're only the other side of the M25 in Hillingdon and Uxbridge, where, you know, people like Glenn Gunner and Rocky and Diesel all came from, Dean Thatcher, we're all from, you know, West London, really. Moving something into Central London, I was a little bit nervous, but, you know, that was the thing of legends. It was small, and they were queuing around the block. Well, they were queuing around the back of the Astoria, basically.
That's amazing. And what were the sort of you know, what was the musical style at that time? Was it straight out house, or were you still mixing up with hip hop? What was going on?
Well, it was still a bit sort of back end of Balearic, I guess, and house, and then I guess into end of 90 and 91 went pretty flipping mental Italian. There's a lot of Italian stuff going around. So yeah, it was Balearic into house, really, and we're always into the American stuff. You know, I remember going, my first trips to New York were 1992, 1993, when I went over there to go to the Limelight and all the rest of it, and to buy records and connect with, you know, Morales and Knuckles and all of those people that we wanted to see and work with. So we always had that American house vibe going on as well.
And with the Italian thing, was that part of the reason that you decided to do the infamous trips to Rimini?
Yeah, it was. That was instigated by ID Magazine, actually. I can't remember his name. I remember they went before me and did this big article about Rimini. And I just, we had the success of ID for 90. I just decided we wanted to do something different. So off we trundled to Rimini, and that's how I ended up doing DC-10 and being involved with the Italians there from 2000, something like that, to 2006. I was involved with that because out of Rimini, I became really good friends with DJ Cirillo, who's one of my best friends. And we lost contact for about 6 years. We've been really good friends. And then I just bumped into him at Space, and he said, you've got to come and check this new place we're doing out, which is an afters. And the rest is history, as they say. And then that's when they asked my wife Jo to be the resident, and we had 6 very mental years. But that all stems from, I think, you know, Rimini 91 and 92.
Are there any moments from Rimini that really stand out? The reason I ask is a couple of mates of mine went to one of them, and they said there was some mad Italian driver that tried to knock everyone over.
I actually had to jump up onto the wall as you come out of Peter Pan. He was trying to run people over, and if you imagine a couple of big gates with walls either side, the walls were about 4 foot high, and he drove at us, and I had to jump up on the wall using my elbows and lift my legs up. He smashed into the wall below me. It was just absolutely bonkers. And then I was talking to James, his uncle, the other day. And he said, best night for me was Peter Pan, and that was that same night. He said, but the after party on the boat was the maddest thing ever. And it was basically, I don't even know how we organised it. It was, you know, we went down to the beach. There was a bit of madness on the beach. got on this, you know, boat party, and it went out, and it was going so crazy that the next minute it was a proper Hawaii 5-0 helicopter, you know, one that can land on the sea, hovering over us, telling the captain to turn it in and get back. So we didn't get too far. I mean, I can still see it clearly in my head, looking up at this helicopter with coppers in it, with a big glass bubble like that, going, turn around, turn around. So yeah, it was an outrageous time. It was brilliant.
And obviously, it's really hard to pin down moments from over the years. But is there anything else that strikes you, particularly from around that period, that sort of 88 to 92 period, that really stands out for you?
Just the networking thing that I think we had a big part in being part of, like going from taking what we were doing from London to Nottingham, which was what we did at Venus once a month. And then one of the things that was pretty outstanding in my mind was being in Venus, and on the first one, went from being invited to do the party and me asking James Bailey, who was running it, and Sam Bowery, who I'm still friends with now, saying, God, do they know us up here? Because I went up there to see Flowered Up, and he was like, you're joking. And then ironically, I was worrying about, could we fill a club on two floors with 750 people in Nottingham? And in the end, we only sold 150 tickets in Nottingham because we sold 350 in London without a flyer being printed. We took 9 coaches from Flying Records in Kensington and then sold 50 tickets in Leeds, 50 in Manchester, 50 in Birmingham type thing. And I remember being in there thinking, Jesus Christ, if it wasn't for Acid House and Pills, this would be a riot 5 years ago, because there were all these people that, you know, I was into football, I still am, but, you know, there was Birmingham's in there, there was Aston Villa in there was Leeds United, there was Man United and Man City fans who we knew, all just raving on, and just threw all that aggression out the window. I remember thinking, bloody hell, what's this about? Everybody from these different cities getting on with each other.
I mean, that was one of the brilliant things about that era, wasn't it? The fact that the whole football rivalry thing seemed to take a back seat because everyone was having such a good time.
Unbelievable. And there was another time as well, remember when the lights came on in Limelight on a Friday night, and it was, you know, I was normally the last one out by Father Hoover coming out to clean the place up. And I was at the bar, not going anywhere. And I remember looking around thinking, bloody hell. I mean, that was obviously all London. And everybody hanging around the bar was Chelsea, Tottenham, Millwall, Arsenal, West Ham. And just all having them, all just out of their brains, basically. Loved up cuddling each other. I was thinking, 2 years ago, it would have been an utter riot in there. It just brought that all, just stopped it dead in its tracks, nearly. Even the police admitted it. The football violence changed because of Acid House.
People were just too happy to fight.
Yeah, exactly. Very happy.
And is there a particular tune? Again, I know it's hard to tie down, but is there a particular tune from that era that really, really stands out for you? I certainly know that when you went to Rimini, a friend of mine came back saying that that Everybody Be Somebody was the tune of one of those Rimini's, but I don't know if you've got a personal favourite from that time.
I think it was Last Rhythm.
Yeah.
That was Italian, a big... I mean, when I hear that now, it makes me... But it wasn't... There was a lot of cheesy Italian stuff. It was all coming out of this shop called Disco Pew.
Oh, yeah.
At the time. I love that. I can still remember it. But there was this big... Yeah, I think it was Last Rhythm. Yeah. But I've always been a massive fan of Unfinished Symphonies, my track at that time.
Oh, yeah, you know, it's just great tune.
Still is, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just timeless.
Yeah.
You know, you hear it now and you think, how can that be 30 years old? Do you know what I mean? So...
And finally, Charlie, obviously one of the most iconic TV shows of the kind of clubbing generation, and you were a part of it. I'm talking about a short film about Chilling. How did that all come about?
Oh, that goes down to the Limelight again, where a very, very talented guy called Kevin Sampson, who's wrote a lot of big... Did he do Powder?
He did Powder, yeah.
He's wrote... Well, you know Kevin, don't you?
Yeah, really? Yeah, I've met him. He did Powder. He did a football one as well.
Yeah, he's done a lot. I mean, he's so creative. I saw him... I think I saw him last year when I was in... I went to Liverpool Man City and I was up there and I went and met the farm. So he used to manage the farm. But he had this thing up his sleeve that he wanted to do. And he came looking for Terry Farley and me. And he was standing outside the limelight shouting our names out as we came out. And then he told us about this TV series, Channel 4, and we were having none of it. We were like, no, we're not taking a TV crew to IB for our... Because I did a trip. I took 500 DJs, 23 DJs, the Farm 808 State, a man called Adam, and about 500-600 people. And he wouldn't leave us alone. My family are from Liverpool, so I'm not. But, you know, I'm a big fan of Scousers. They're funny as you like. And he just scoused me out, basically. He wouldn't leave me alone. And then he asked to come out one night in Soho about a week later, and it was just the funniest night. And in the end, he disappeared. And we were like, where's that nutbag Samson gone? And I said, look, there he is over there. And he was literally on the floor under the table. I went, we may as well do it with him, mate. I just thought, if they're going to do this, if someone's going to do something about Ibiza, we may as well have some sort of control over it to make sure they do it right. And that guy looks like he's going to do it right because he's under the table. Do you know what I mean? He wasn't just some, you know, producer that was going to get it wrong, and he got it so right. I think it had 13.5 million viewers. That it was aired in August, and then again on Boxing Day that same year, and it had already got a reputation for itself. So it was something like 10:45 in the morning on Boxing Day. What are you actually doing 10:45 in the morning? You know. Houses are full of people getting up for Christmas, and unless you're walking the dog or getting ready to football, and it just came on at the right time, and people were like, oh, wow, whack that on. And that was that. It's a big, big program, right?
Charlie, that's a brilliant story. I love that. I love the fact 13.5 million people are watching that on Boxing Day. That's so good.
No, it's absolutely irate. And people still talk about it now all the time, you know, so... Yeah, I'm very proud of that. But, you know, we took them over. I nearly ended up driving their van back to Liverpool because the drivers, two drivers, drove the van over with all the equipment, and they couldn't deal with it. They left the van and got a plane home.
Well, because it was all too much.
Ended up going out every single night with all of us, and they just burnt out. And I remember. They're working out how to get the van back. I thought it'd be a great laugh to drive it through France. I never did it, but it was on my mind.
Brilliant. Charlie, this has been fantastic. Thanks so much for your time. We won't take up any more of your time, but that was bloody awesome. Thank you. And we'll play your we'll play your tune at some point in the show as well. So Last Rhythm is the one, yeah?
I think so. Let me check with my wife and I'll WhatsApp you now. Yeah,
okay.
Amazing. Thank you so much,
I'll
mate.
Double check. I'll Google it as well.
That was
That
was way better than I even thought. That was amazing. Thank you so much, mate. You basically dominated the whole show. We've got nothing else to say.
that was always going to happen.
Take care. See you later, mate.
Cheers.
Thank you, mate. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I think it, for me, it sums up that time. It sums up a time when, I don't know when it was still, when it wasn't a thing. You didn't know what it was. It was just, he was just doing it. And there was, well, I was at school at the time, there was like five or six of us out of our school doing it. Everyone else thought we were weird. And I think it was still a camaraderie. When that song played, there was only certain people who knew what that song was about.
Brilliant. Well, what a fantastic way to end the show. Last Rhythm by Last Rhythm, chosen by Charlie Chester. This is Pipe and Slipmats, Volume 4, signing out.